Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 268, but who's counting? It's Monday, August 5th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's get started with a story that's very interesting and something that I've been looking at very closely in recent months and years. This is a story from The Hill on Gen X and millennials facing higher risk of cancer than other generations. So what I've been looking at is it seems to be the case that each successive generation is less healthy than the one that came before it. So unfortunately, when we're looking at, for instance, life expectancy, we look at all the death rates for the different ages and then project somebody at birth, if they had experienced each of those death rates, how long could they be expected to live? Well, that assumes a world, for instance, that has a childhood of older folks that doesn't exist anymore. We live in a different world, and apparently the world today and 20 years ago and 40 years ago and 60 years ago, each progressive generation is having apparently a younger part of life, and the developmental phase of life is particularly important for health and longevity, seems to be getting less and less healthy, not the direction we want to be going. And of course, as far as looking at life expectancy, it would put downward pressure on that as time goes on. So, this story on cancer. Generation X and millennials face a higher risk of getting certain types of cancer when compared to earlier generations, according to a large study. In a study published in the Lancet Public Health Journal, researchers from the American Cancer Society studied 34 of the most common cancers. They found that cancer incidence rates continued to rise in progressively younger generations in 17 of the 34 cancers, including breast, pancreatic, and gastric cancers. For 8 of those 17 cancers, researchers found that cancer incidence rates rose for each successive birth cohort since 1920. For 9 of them, incidence rates increased in younger cohorts after first declining in older birth cohorts. So it's even worse. We were seeing those rates actually going down in these older birth cohorts, and then they started going up again. These findings add to growing evidence of increased cancer risk in post-baby boomer generations, expanding on previous findings of early-onset colorectal cancer and a few obesity-associated cancers to encompass a broader range of cancer types, said Juana Sung, lead author of the study. The study highlighted the need to identify and address the underlying risk factors in Gen X and millennial populations to explain and address these rising cancer rates in younger generations, said Ahmadine Jamal, a senior author of the study. Birth cohorts, groups of people classified by their birth year, share unique social, economic, political, and climate environments, which affect their exposure to cancer risk factors during their crucial developmental years, Sung added. Although we have identified cancer trends associated with birth years, we don't yet have a clear explanation for why these rates are rising. The study was conducted using data from more than 23 million patients diagnosed with 34 types of cancers during the period beginning January 1, 2000 and ending December 31, 2019. The study also looked at mortality data from more than 7 million deaths for 25 types of cancers during the same period of time. The individuals were all between the ages of 25 and 84. The researchers then calculated the incident rate ratios for each birth cohort, adjusted for age effect and period effect. The cancer incidence rate for the youngest birth cohort, 1990, range from 12% higher than the birth cohort with the lowest rate for ovarian cancer to 169% higher than the birth cohort with the lowest rate for uterine cancer. The cancer incident rate was also 2 to 3 times higher for the 1990 birth cohort than for the 1955 birth cohort for pancreatic, kidney, and small intestinal cancers. Jamal warned of the implications for such rising cancer rates. The increase in cancer rates among this younger group of people indicate generational shifts in cancer risk and often serve as an early indicator of future cancer burden in the country. Without effective population-level interventions, and as the elevated risk of younger generations is carried over as individuals age, an overall increase in cancer burden could occur in the future, halting or reversing decades of progress against the disease. Wow. Wow, that's a lot of bad news. I did want to highlight one area of good news, and that was with the HPV vaccines. The infection of HPV can lead to cervical and other cancers. And that has been going down since we have widespread HPV vaccines that are given to youngsters. Okay, as far as what the cause of this is, 10 of the 17 cancers with increasing incidence are, in fact, obesity-related, so that's part of it. And I went and looked at the actual journal article, and we have this such description. The effect of exposures to other suspected risk factors, such as unhealthy diet, sedentary lifestyle, altered sleep patterns, and environmental chemicals during early life and young adulthood on cancer risk, as well as birth cohort trends and the prevalence of these factors, remain poorly understood. Some dietary patterns, such as those high in saturated fats, refined grains, ultra-processed foods, and sugar, as well as the meat versus plant diets, and sedentary behaviors during adolescence and young adulthood have been associated with increased risk of some cancers, most consistently for colorectal and breast cancers. The constellation of gastrointestinal tract cancers, including those but not necessarily associated with obesity, for example, small intestine and gastric cancers, that are increasing in incidence in recent birth cohorts, highlight the potential involvement of an altered microbiome, given substantial changes in dietary patterns and antibiotic use in particular over the past few decades. So there's probably a lot of culprits. They don't get into great detail here, but like I reported last week, there was a huge study on pesticide exposure, local pesticide exposure from farm agricultural use, and showed increased cancer rates. So that's one example. Of course, we've got the plastics crisis and a lot of endocrine disrupting chemicals around, PFAS, you name it. There's a whole bunch of things that are far more prevalent now than they were a generation or two or three ago. Okay, well, let's switch gears a lot and go to a story touching on bird flu. This from Science Alert. Scientists confirm bird flu is now spreading between mammals. As health authorities have suspected for some time now, bird flu is consistently being spread between mammals, increasing the risk of sustained outbreaks emerging among humans in the future. This is one of the first times that we are seeing evidence of efficient and sustained mammalian-to-mammalian transmission, says Cornell University virologist Diego Diehl. The concern is that potential mutations could arise that could lead to adaptation to mammals, spillover into humans, and potential efficient transmission in humans in the future, explains Diehl. Concerns over H5N1's potential are based largely on its talent for stealing genes from other influenza viruses, coupled with its ability to easily jump between different mammalian species. It has now been detected in mammals from the Arctic to the Antarctic, including polar bears, otters, squirrels, dolphins, elephant seals, Antarctic fur seals, and goats. I don't think we have a good understanding of the molecular reason why these viruses, with this combination of gene segments, with these mutations, now have this inherent ability of infecting many more species than in the past, molecular virologist Daniel Perez told Smithsonian Magazine earlier this year. So this is just one step in the march towards a potential pandemic from bird flu. Stay tuned. Okay, well, let's switch gears again and do three stories on dementia and preventive factors. This from MedPage Today. Expert panel says target these 14 factors to cut dementia incidence by nearly half. The Lancet Commission on Dementia Prevention, Intervention, and Care has raised the number of modifiable risk factors definitively linked to cognitive loss to 14, based on research conducted since its last update in 2020. Vision loss and high levels of low-density lipoprotein cholesterol are now added to the Commission's list, which stood at 12 in the previous version. The new 57-page update was published in The Lancet. The 14 factors include education, hearing loss, depression, head trauma, physical activity, smoking, hypertension, obesity, type 2 diabetes, drinking alcohol, social isolation, air pollution, vision loss, and high LDL cholesterol. If all of these were fully addressed, providing higher education to everyone, ending obesity, making helmet use mandatory for youth, eliminating air pollution, etc., worldwide risk for dementia would fall by 45%, the commission found in its review of nearly 600 scientific publications. About 7% of dementia risk can be attributed to the high LDL cholesterol, according to the report, making it one of the most powerful risk factors. Also accounting for 7% is unaddressed hearing loss, social isolation, and low education, which are tied for third on the list at 5% of a population attributable risk each. Other factors account for 3% or less. The authors put the effect of untreated vision loss at 2%, and we'll get to that in a moment. Okay, well, listeners, if you're listening out there, you may think, oh, these factors only 7%, 7%, 7%, 5%, 5%, 5%, 3%, 3%, 2%. How much could each of those really matter? Well, this is over the entire population. And of course, some people have those risks, some people don't. So if you actually break it down per risk factor and break it down into a risk ratio, which is, for instance, for the people who have those risk factors versus the people that don't, you see much higher differentials, which might be more convincing as far as actually wanting individually to change and societally to get the political pressure in order to make whatever changes are necessary. And that brings us as an example to our next article from Stat News, Vision Loss and High Cholesterol Identified as Risk Factors for Dementia. So, untreated vision loss and high LDL cholesterol have been added as two new potentially modifiable risk factors for dementia. Avoidable vision loss and blindness are estimated to affect 13% of adults age 50 and older. By conducting a meta-analysis on 14 cohort studies, the commission found a 47% increase in risk for dementia in adults who have untreated vision loss. In another meta-analysis, cataracts and diabetic retinopathy had significant associations with dementia risk. Follow-up studies in the U.S. found that those who had cataract extractions had significantly reduced risk for dementia, a 29% decrease, as opposed to those who did not have cataract extractions. Cataracts are marked by the lens of the eye becoming cloudy and resulting in hazy vision. The role of vision loss as a risk factor in dementia can be compared to the loss of hearing, identified as another risk factor in a previous report. One of the ways in which both vision and hearing act in terms of cognitive stimulation, people who have hearing loss have a reduction in the volume of their temporal lobe in the brain. Molecular changes in the retina affect processes like circadian rhythms, which are responsible for regulating the sleep-wake cycle. There's also a social aspect of vision loss that plays into dementia risk. People who have these losses go out less, see other people less, and are much more likely to become socially isolated. So, as it is in many cases, when you look at an entire population, it's very complicated. 14 risks that have been definitively identified as preventing dementia, if we took care of them all, that would cut almost in half the amount of Alzheimer's happening. And in even more news on that front, this from CNN, replacing processed red meats with beans or nuts cuts dementia risk by 20%. Dementia risk rose by 14% when people ate about 1 ounce of processed red meat a day, the equivalent of slightly less than 2 3-ounce servings a week, compared to people who ate about 3 servings a month, a preliminary new study found. The risk for dementia dropped by 20%, however, for people who replace that small daily serving of processed red meat with a daily serving of nuts and legumes. Processed red meat, such as bacon, sausage, hot dogs, and deli meats, often contain higher levels of sodium, nitrates, and saturated fat. Eating higher amounts of these meats has been strongly linked to the development of colon and other cancers, type 2 diabetes, and heart disease and stroke, studies have shown. There's much we can do to reduce the risk of dementia, starting with actions that are well known to reduce risks of cardiovascular disease, said Dr. Walter Willett, professor of epidemiology and nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health. So the good news here is that some of these risk factors cut across a wide variety. You don't have to have a special diet just for dementia. If you follow a diet that's good for other health things like cardiovascular disease prevention or cancer prevention, you get many of the same benefits. A good diet is a good diet for many things. Okay, well, let's switch gears again and take in a global perspective on another issue, this being adolescent girls facing intimate partner violence. This is from Medical Express. Adolescent girls face alarming rates of intimate partner violence, analysis reveals. Among adolescent girls who have been in a relationship, nearly a quarter, 24%, which is close to 19 million people globally, will have experienced physical and/or sexual intimate partner violence by the time they turn 20 years old, as highlighted by a new analysis from the World Health Organization and published in The Lancet Child and Adolescent Health. Almost 1 in 6, or 16%, experience such violence within the past year. Intimate partner violence is starting alarmingly early for millions of young women around the world, said Dr. Paxel Alote, director of the WHO's Sexual and Reproductive Health and Research Department. Given that violence during these critical formative years can cause profound and lasting harm, it needs to be taken more seriously as a public health issue, with a focus on prevention and targeted support. Partner violence can have devastating impacts on young people's health, educational achievement, future relationships, and lifelong prospects. From a health perspective, it heightens the likelihood of injuries, depression, anxiety disorders, unplanned pregnancies, sexually transmitted infections, and many other physical and psychological conditions. While violence against adolescent girls occurs everywhere, the authors highlight significant differences in prevalence. Based on WHO's estimates, the worst affected regions are Oceania, affecting 47% versus the 24% globally, and Central Sub-Saharan Africa at 40%, for instance, while the lowest rates are in Central Europe at 10% and Central Asia at 11%. Between countries, there's also a substantive range, from an estimated 6% of adolescent girls subjected to such violence in the least affected countries to 49% in those with the highest rates. The new analysis found that intimate partner violence against adolescent girls is most common in lower-income countries and regions, in places where there are fewer girls in secondary school, and where girls have weaker legal property ownership and inheritance rights compared to men. Child marriage, that is marriage before the age of 18 years old, significantly escalates risk, since spousal age difference creates power imbalances, economic dependency, and social isolation, all of which increase the likelihood of enduring abuse. The study highlights the urgent need to strengthen support services and early prevention measures tailored for adolescents, alongside actions to advance women's and girls' agency and rights from school-based programs that educate both boys and girls on healthy relationships and violence prevention to legal protections and economic empowerment. This means ensuring secondary education for all girls, securing gender equal property rights, and ending harmful practices such as child marriage, which are often underpinned by the same inequitable gender norms that perpetuate violence against women and girls. Currently, no country is on track to eliminate violence against women and girls by the 2030 Sustainable Development Goal target date. Ending child marriage, which affects 1 in 5 girls globally, and expanding girls' access to secondary education will be critical factors for reducing partner violence against adolescent girls. The WHO supports countries to measure and address violence against women, including efforts to strengthen prevention and responses within the healthcare sector. New WHO guidelines on prevention of child marriage are planned for release by the end of this year. And I would just like to reiterate that if you were to pick one factor that would be indicative of a healthy population, that indicator would be the status of women. We need to improve the status of women and girls to improve the health for all. And on that front, we go get back to America here. I want to talk about some abortion articles. First up from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. Since the fall of Roe, self-managed abortions have increased. The percentage of people who say they've tried to end a pregnancy without medical assistance increased after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. That's according to a study published in the online journal JAMA Network Open. The new study is from Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health, a research group based at the University of California, San Francisco. The researchers surveyed more than 7,000 people aged 15 to 49 from December 2021 to January 2022, and another 7,000 plus from June 2023 to July 2023. Of the respondents who had attempted self-managed abortions, they found the percentage who used the abortion pill mifepristone was 11% in 2023, up from 6.6% before the Supreme Court ended federal abortion rights in 2022. One of the most common reasons for seeking a self-administered abortion was privacy concerns, said study co-author epidemiologist Lauren Ralph. So not wanting others to know that they were seeking or in need of an abortion or wanted to maintain autonomy in a decision, they liked it was something under their controls that they could do on their own. In the JAMA study, women who self-managed abortion attempts reported using a range of methods, including drugs or alcohol, lifting heavy objects, and taking a hot bath. In addition, about 22% reported hitting themselves in the stomach. Nearly 4% reported inserting an object in their body. The term self-managed abortion may conjure images of back alley procedures in the 1950s and 60s, but OB-GYN Laura Larson, a family planning physician in Chicago, said self-managed abortions using medication abortion, the drugs mifepristone and misoprostol, are far safer whether done inside or outside the healthcare system. They're equally safe no matter which way you do it. So this is a frightening portrait of a facet of healthcare or lack thereof in America, that women are actually being forced to do these self-managed abortion attempts that are not the medically safe and unfortunately not as widely available as they should be, the drugs mifepristone and misoprostol. We need to make abortion safe and available for all who need it. Unfortunately, states that have restricted access to abortion are doing a whole variety of things to make that situation even worse. This from the 19th. States have increased anti-abortion center funding by nearly $500 million since Roe fell. In the 2 years since Roe v. Wade's overturn, states have increased public funding for anti-abortion centers, the non-medical facilities meant to dissuade people from terminating their pregnancies, by close to $500 million, according to a new analysis. The analysis was compiled by Equity Forward, a research organization that supports abortion rights and specifically tracks anti-abortion centers, which are also known as crisis pregnancy centers. Researchers use state budget documents and legislation to track how much money has been invested in these centers since 1995, the first year they could verify public funding for them. These facilities have become a flashpoint in the 2 years since Roe's demise brought the end of federal abortion rights. They typically offer free pregnancy tests and sonograms, and some also provide parenting classes or diapers, but they are not regulated under the same standards as medical facilities and do not always employ staff health professionals. That means these ultrasounds can be inaccurate, and they can come with counseling meant to dissuade people from terminating their pregnancies. Still, in some states with abortion bans, pregnant patients, including those seeking terminations, have said such centers offer the only affordable option in their region for getting an ultrasound. Even before the fall of Roe, these centers outnumbered abortion clinics 3-1, according to research from the University of Georgia. Now, with abortion almost totally outlawed in 14 states and significantly restricted in several more, abortion opponents have pushed for boosting state funding for these centers. Some have tried to open new facilities in states seeing an uptick in abortion patients. Conservative lawmakers, skittish about the political backlash associated with pushing for unpopular new bans, have heeded abortion opponents' calls to promote these centers instead. Measures expanding funding for these centers were the most common form of anti-abortion legislation promoted in state governments this year, with 9 states boosting financial support, according to the Guttmacher Institute, which tracks reproductive health policy. The new report shines light on how successful those efforts have been, painting a picture of dramatic growth in just a few years. From 1995 to 2024, researchers found states collectively put more than $1 billion into backing these centers. Some solely used state funds, while others also repurposed federal funds allocated through the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. Specifically, since Roe's fall in 2022, state funding has risen. $489 million was allocated in just the last 2 years, as 19 states poured funding into anti-abortion centers. It's really alarming. States have chosen to take millions of dollars from comprehensive maternal health and instead funnel money into anti-abortion centers without much oversight or accountability, said Ashley Underwood, Equity Forward's director. The impact is visible, said Kathy Kleinfeld, who runs a reproductive health clinic in Houston. While her staff can no longer provide abortions, they still counsel patients about the option, including sharing which clinics in nearby states could terminate their pregnancies. For one thing, Kleinfeld said, online advertisements from anti-abortion clinics are far more common than they were just a few years ago. They are actively, aggressively coming up on the first page, always after doing the first search for either abortion pill or abortion clinic, anything. Anytime you're searching any one of those major keywords, there's at least three or four anti-abortion centers. Increasingly, she has to direct her employees to warn patients who are calling around for appointments to make sure they do not go to one of these centers instead. Even if the centers can offer a visit sooner, she said, the information they provide may not be accurate. Okay, well, next up, I want to switch to another topic that is often seen as controversial, guns. This first one from Medical Express. As many as 65 million Americans now own firearms specifically for protection, survey suggests. Some 65 million Americans now own firearms for protection, around 80% of the country's estimated 81 million gun owners, suggest the results of a nationally representative survey carried out in 2023 and published online in the journal Injury Prevention. This perceived need is changing the profile of gun owners, the findings indicate, with increasing numbers of women and those of minority ethnic backgrounds citing protection as the primary reason for owning a firearm. In 2021, firearms caused the highest absolute number of deaths on record in the U.S., taking nearly 49,000 lives. This death toll coincided with a surge in firearm purchases during the COVID-19 pandemic, adding 7.5 million owners to the existing total. The reasons for gun ownership in the U.S. have steadily evolved from tools of necessity to tools of self-defense, facilitated in part by the liberalization of firearm policies, the conservatization of firearm policies, such as concealed carry and stand your ground legislation, note the researchers. In 2017 to 2021, between 60 and 70% of firearm owners cited protection as the primary reason for ownership, compared with only 48% in 2013 and only 26% in 1999. Among those who said they owned a gun, 79% cited protection as the most important reason for doing so, and 58% reported carrying a firearm outside their home in the past 12 months. Given that over 81 million Americans are estimated to own firearms, this equates to around 65 million people owning firearms for protection, calculate the researchers. Ownership for protection was not notably higher among firearm owners living in stand-your-ground states, but firearm owners in these states were more likely to carry a gun outside of the home, 50% versus 35% in states without stand-your-ground legislation. Ownership for protection was characterized by more frequent carriage, despite owning fewer firearms, and more first-time firearm owners. Gender and race ethnicity emerge as factors strongly associated with ownership for protection. Women, Black and Hispanic people, were more likely to own firearms for protection than other reasons. Moreover, Black and Asian women, 99% prevalent, almost exclusively owned a gun for protection. And while fewer men cited protection as their primary motivation for owning a gun, owning for protection was more common among Black men at 89% than it was among white men at 70%. Other characteristics, including political affiliation, were not significantly associated with the desire to own a gun for protection. Neither was knowing someone who had been shot or killed by a firearm. But the feeling that there was no way that they could trust or rely on was more common among those who cited protection as the primary reason for gun ownership. These 2023 estimates are higher than previous years, indicating a continuing trend where firearm ownership is now predominantly motivated by protection and appealing to demographics beyond the, quote, traditional firearm owner, including women and minority races, regardless of political affiliation, write the researchers. Stand your ground laws specifically affect the legal right to use deadly force for self-defense in public places, and therefore increased firearm carriage might be the mechanism by which states with stand-your-ground laws have contributed to higher rates of firearm violence, they suggest. the simultaneous relaxing of concealed carry laws and strengthening self-defense laws may be reinforcing firearm behaviors for protection, particularly carriage in public places. And just as a reminder, those that own a gun are much more likely to kill somebody they know than they are to prevent a shooting or such from a stranger. In fact, those that own a gun are more likely to have that gun kill themselves than to kill another person, since suicide is the leading cause of death in firearm deaths. And of course, unintentional deaths is also a factor. This next story gets to that. This from Medical Express. Southeastern states have the highest unintentional gun death rates. There's more than a tenfold difference in the rates of unintentional gun deaths across U.S. states, with such incidents claiming more than 12,000 lives between 2001 and 2021, finds research published online in the journal Injury Prevention. Poverty, rural residency, non-white ethnicity, and firearm ownership are all associated with higher rates of unintentional gun deaths, the findings show. Firearms kill over 130 Americans every day. Most of these deaths are intentional, but of the 48,830 firearm-related deaths in 2021, 549 were unintentional, noted the researchers. Another way to put that is over 10 a week. Analysis of all the data showed that there's more than a tenfold difference in the rates of unintentional gun deaths across U.S. states. The highest rates clustered in the southeastern states, followed by states in the northern plains and mountain west. The highest unadjusted rates were in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama. The lowest rates were in the Northeast. Research like this just begs the question in public policy of having safe firearm storage, keeping your guns unloaded and locked up. Of course, in tandem with the previous story about people doing it for personal protection, often in their home, that trend tends to have people keep a gun loaded, unlocked for easy access, in, of course, the primary reason they're looking at for personal defense. Not a good trend for driving unintentional deaths. And, of course, the intentional ones of suicide as well. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's switch to a few stories on healthcare. This from Medical Express. Study finds gaps in mental health care for people with chronic pain. A new University of Arizona Health Sciences study found that adults with chronic pain are more likely to experience symptoms of anxiety and depression than people without chronic pain. Yet they access mental health care at lower rates and are less likely to have their mental health needs met during treatment. In 2021, approximately 51.6 million U.S. adults experienced chronic pain, according to the CDC. The study showed that while people living with chronic pain represent 20% of the U.S. adult population, they make up an estimated 56% of U.S. adults with clinically significant anxiety and depressive symptoms. This study builds on a previous Comprehensive Center for Pain and Addiction research that found 1 in 20 U.S. adults have a combination of chronic pain and symptoms of anxiety or depression. And adults living with chronic pain are approximately 5 times more likely to have untreated symptoms for anxiety and depression compared to those not living with chronic pain. The new study examines the degree to which people with chronic pain and mental health symptoms accessed and benefited from mental health treatment. The research team analyzed data from about 32,000 people who participated in the National Health Interview Survey, which has been identified as the best single source for the surveillance of chronic pain. Researchers identified chronic pain-associated disparities in 3 areas: the need for mental health treatment, the use of mental health treatment, and the success of treating anxiety and depressive symptoms while mental health treatment was used. They found that 43% of U.S. adults living with chronic pain, approximately 22 million people, had a mental health need. By comparison, mental health care needs were identified in only 17% of U.S. adults who did not have chronic pain. Among all U.S. adults with mental health treatment needs, chronic pain was associated with a 40% reduction in the odds of using mental health treatment. For those with chronic pain, the narrative about what needs to be done to address mental health is qualitatively different than for those who don't have chronic pain. Improving healthcare for people with chronic pain includes not only connecting people to care, but also addressing a disproportionate failure to achieve relief, even in the context of caregiving. Researchers found that when mental health treatment is used, U.S. adults with chronic pain are more than twice as likely as others to experience continuing anxiety or depressive symptoms. The study found that only 44% of people with chronic pain, and almost 10 million people, used mental health services and had their anxiety and depressive symptoms adequately treated, compared with 72% of those without chronic pain. When mental health treatment was used, U.S. adults with chronic pain are more than twice as likely as others to experience continuing anxiety or depression symptoms. There are many possible reasons an individual with chronic pain might get suboptimal results from mental health care, including the accessibility of care and the feasibility of attending appointments. Additionally, few mental health providers are trained in chronic pain, so only a small percentage of people living with chronic pain are likely receiving mental health treatment that is designed to address their needs. Okay, next up from Medical Express, common medical billing errors keep many Americans away from care. Insured working age adults are frequently being hit with medical bills for services that should have been covered, a new Commonwealth Fund survey has found. Close to half, that is 45% of insured workers, have received a bill or copay in the past year for a service they thought should have been paid by health insurance. Fewer than half challenged the bills, mostly because they weren't aware they had the right to do so, researchers found. But when they did mount a challenge, patients often found the bill had indeed been issued in error. More than one-third, 38% of those who disputed medical bills, had their bill reduced or eliminated. Our findings highlight a troubling reality. Even with health insurance, many Americans are struggling to navigate a complex and often opaque healthcare system, said Commonwealth Fund President Dr. Joseph Betancourt. The same goes for getting insurance to agree to cover medical services, with many being turned down in error. Nearly 17% of patients were denied coverage by their insurer for a doctor-recommended service. But half of adults who challenged a coverage denial reported success in getting some or all of the denied services. These coverage denials had a direct impact on patients' health. Nearly 60% said a denial led to delay in their care, and nearly half had their symptoms worsen as a result. When substantial numbers of people with health insurance are facing unexpected bills and having doctor-recommended care denied, our healthcare system is failing patients, said researcher Sarah Collins, Commonwealth Fund Senior Scholar and Vice President for Healthcare Coverage and Access. And much of this failure can be attributed to the complex insurer billing practices and loopholes that fuel a lack of accountability for these billing errors and unfair coverage denials. Among people who didn't challenge a billing error, more than half said it was because they weren't sure that they had the right to do so. Patients deserve better. They shouldn't have to navigate a labyrinth to use the health insurance they and their employers are paying for and the care their doctors are prescribing. Especially as some commercial insurers are reporting record profits, we must ensure that health insurance fulfills its promise of protecting people's health and financial well-being. And of course, as financial well-being goes, American healthcare is the number one leading cause of personal bankruptcy in this country. Okay, next up, also from MedPage Today, trust in doctors crashed during the COVID pandemic and remains low. Trust in physicians and hospitals decreased sharply during the COVID-19 pandemic, and higher levels of trust were tied to greater odds of getting vaccinated for COVID-19 or influenza, according to a survey study of U.S. adults. Among over 400,000 unique respondents, the proportion of adults who agreed that there had a lot of trust in physicians and hospitals declined from 72% in April 2020 to 40% in January 2024, reported Roy Perlis of Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston and colleagues in JAMA Network Open. In regression models, factors associated with lower trust as of the spring and summer of 2023 included being 25 to 64 years of age, female gender, lower educational level, lower income, black race, and living in a rural setting. Even when the research is controlled for partisanship, these associations persisted. We as physicians and public health officials can talk until we're blue in the face about things like vaccination and other public health behaviors, Perlis commented. But if people don't trust us, it doesn't matter. We're talking to ourselves. The decrease in trust during the pandemic could have long-lasting implications for public health in the U.S., he added. Perlis and his team also gathered information about why respondents had low levels of trust. Participants with the two lowest levels of trust identified the following reasons: financial motives over patient care, 35% of respondents. Poor quality of care and negligence, 28%. Influence of external entities and agendas, 14%. And discrimination and bias, 5%. Results were also not fully accounted for by the general distrust in science, suggesting some specificity for medicine per se, the authors wrote. So this drop is mostly a move from a high level of trust to just some level of trust. So there's still a fair amount of some level or a high level, but that high level of trust that existed before the pandemic has been shattered. Okay, well, last up in my regular reporting, I want to report on a really interesting little story just tying together a bunch of things of how public health can be impacted by things not often seen ahead of time. This from the Environmental Health Network. How the vulture decline in India led to a human health crisis. The near extinction of vultures in India due to a cattle drug has caused over 500,000 excess human deaths from rabies and polluted water. Vultures in India nearly vanished in the 1990s due to the drug diclofenac used on cattle. The decline led to increased carcass pollution, feral dogs, and rabies, causing significant human deaths. Economists highlight the essential role of keystone species in maintaining human health and safety. Why this matters? The collapse of vulture populations reveals the role of keystone species in ecosystems. Vultures, often seen as nature's cleanup crew, are essential for their ability to consume carcasses, thereby preventing the spread of disease and supporting a balanced ecosystem. So, of course, the spread of disease is two primary things. One, dead carcasses pollute water, not good. And also, you get feral dogs that transfer rabies. Yikes. Okay, well, that brings us to our last feature, bonus articles. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give that link again at the end of the list. Okay, 34 bonus articles this week. Let's get to it. First up, let's start with the single largest preventable cause of death in the world and in this country, smoking. Vaping and smoking together increases lung cancer risk fourfold. So this was a case control study, which might have a few limitations that I'd be concerned about, that maybe that risk isn't a fully fourfold, but the fact that's a very large increase, and there's probably some synergistic effect between vaping and cigarette smoking that increases lung cancer risk. Bonus article 2, the indomitable COVID virus, how to respond without denialism or complacency. This is a good long overview of what we're dealing with this COVID summer. The virus just doesn't give up. It just keeps mutating. And it looks like we're talking about today probably 1 million infections a day happen in the U.S. And it is not harmless, especially with that kind of quantity of infections. Bonus article 3. U.S. measles cases are already triple those of last year. I reported on this, and our lower measles vaccination rates are leaving us vulnerable, and with international travel, we're seeing cases that are coming back are actually getting community transmission. Bonus article 4. Hospital-acquired infections and antibiotic-resistant infections are rising. Something I've also reported on a lot. It can be pretty scary, and the next one is a good example of that. Bonus article 5. World Health Organization warns of increase in hypervirulent, multidrug-resistant Klebsiella strains. So Klebsiella is a bacteria that often causes pneumonia in vulnerable persons, often in the hospital. But this new hypervirulent, multidrug-resistant Klebsiella is one that can actually infect healthy people, and rather than just affecting the lungs with pneumonia, it can affect multi-organs. Very nasty. This could be our future. Bonus article 6. CDC urges livestock workers to get seasonal flu vaccine to cut pandemic risk. And this cuts the pandemic risk by avoiding dual infections. So if you get the bird flu and the seasonal flu, that is easily transmitted in human beings, they can potentially exchange genetic material. And this is typically a way that viruses quickly mutate in order to be transferable among humans. So we want to avoid these dual dual infections. So if you get seasonal flu vaccine in livestock workers, which is a much smaller number of people, get the flu vaccine levels up to try to cut down on some flu vaccine infections. It reduces the chance of getting ultimately a bird flu pandemic. Bonus article 7. Experts consider H5N1 bird flu unknowns as state fairs loom. So this is a problem with human-animal interfaces in a lot of places, whether it's, quote, our environment, the wild, but it's also, in this case, talking about state fairs where large numbers of people and large numbers of animals from a lot of different places get together. Bonus article 8. Mpox cases have surged by 160% in Africa so far this year, but few treatments and vaccines available in Africa. So they're available in the richer countries, but where it's centered in the world, we're not taking care of business. So, you know, we really need to be on the front line of this, not waiting for it to come after us. Bonus article 9. Behind the malaria vaccines, a 40-year quest against one of humanity's biggest killers. This is a good long read that'll give you a story behind the malaria vaccines and their development over 40 years. Bonus article 10, patients may be exposed to microplastics through medical procedures. So this is another study just lifting up as an example the larger truth that we live in a plastic-filled world, and even medical procedures that are supposed to be improving our health can expose us to large amounts of microplastics because we're sticking plastics inside the body, running blood through it, etc., etc. Bonus article 11, some condom and lubricant brands contain alarming levels of PFAS, so that's the forever chemical. So just one more place where we're exposed to PFAS, endocrine disrupting chemicals, carcinogenic. Bonus article 12, plastics industry support for waste pickers is often superficial. So waste pickers are those people around the world who go to trash heaps and pick out recyclable materials. These waste pickers account for 58% of post-consumer content that is recycled. And of course, the plastic industry, you know, says inane things like basically, well, if it wasn't for them, they wouldn't have any jobs. Yeah, they're job creators. Yeah, pollution creators as well. Bonus article 13. Oil companies sold the public on a fake climate solution and swindled taxpayers out of billions. The fossil fuel industry's carbon capture bamboozle explain. So carbon capture is another one of these silly, high-tech, expensive things that isn't really going to work and is just a distraction from dealing with the fundamental using of fossil fuels, which is destroying our environment. Bonus article 14, Navajo Nation challenges uranium transport laws on tribal lands. So I reported how about uranium mining is picked back up in the U.S. after Russia is no longer a reliable source for uranium for our nuclear weapons and such. So the Navajo Nation, who has been has had communities devastated by uranium mining, they're trying to challenge in court about the transport on their lands. Bonus article 15, Kansas hospital sued for refusing emergency abortion. About time. I was waiting for this one to drop. So in the continued legal battles over abortion rights, this would be an important case. Bonus article 16, new poll shows Florida abortion amendment winning with bipartisan support. So this is interesting because Florida is a big state. It was the state prior to its six-week abortion ban was the destination for a lot of people in the South who were seeking abortions. And they have a 60% threshold to pass this constitutional state amendment. And they seem to be doing that. And it's, of course, with bipartisan support, even in a red state. You're getting blue and red folks out there voting for it. Very important. 17. States break out new tactics to thwart abortion ballot measures in Arizona, Arkansas, Florida, Montana, and South Dakota. The good news is there are efforts to get abortion ballot measures on those states. The bad news is Republicans keep trying to figure out ways to thwart the ability to vote. They say they want to bring it back to the states, but they really don't want people to vote on it. Bonus article 18, menopause increases your risk of sexually transmitted infections due to how aging changes your body. So we've seen sexually transmitted infections go up quite a bit in elderly folks, and women are particularly vulnerable given changes in their body due to aging. Bonus article 19, ACL tears in women, too many injuries and too little research. Another example of limited research in women, ACL tears in women are actually 3 to 6 times likely compared to men, but we're not studying it to know what to do. Bonus article 20, FDA warns of danger from at-home chemical peels. So you can buy these at-home chemical peels, but they can give you chemical burns on your skin. And if you want such a thing, do it under the supervision of a professional. Bonus article 21, now, a better way to stay younger, a healthy diet with less sugar linked to younger biological age. So a healthy diet overall, but particularly sugar seems to be linked to increasing your biological age. So if you want to reduce it, cut down on sugar. Bonus article 22, 42% of online pharmacies selling weight loss drugs are operating illegally. So these are really expensive drugs. These, you know, Wegovy and such. They're very expensive, and you may not be able to get a prescription, but illegally online without a prescription, you can get hopefully these weight loss drugs, but because they're not being produced in as exact of a manner, you may not be getting what you want, and people who shouldn't be using them may perhaps be using them as well. Bonus article 23, private equity strips and devalues successful hospitals. Yes, private equity in healthcare is more like pirates raiding healthcare. Bonus article 24, study finds low availability of psychiatric appointments for Medicaid patients. So this is an example where, you know, Medicaid coverage is good, but the networks might be awful thin. So even though you might have coverage for a psychiatrist, getting an appointment is not easy. Bonus article 25, cost counseling and stewardship need to be part of medical school curricula. So in medical schools and outside of medical schools, healthcare providers are not trained very much on how to deal with the fact that finances is a huge part of the effectiveness of medicine. If you give a prescription and somebody doesn't take it because they can't afford it, or they're titrating it out, in other words, taking smaller doses to try to make it last, and then they don't feel comfortable talking to their medical provider about that, it can be a real problem. So healthcare providers need to be trained on how to deal with that. Better yet, let's get a healthcare system that actually works for everybody where financial access is not such a huge barrier. Bonus article 26, death from falls have increased 65% in 20 years. And this is actually controlling, if you take people over age 65, that group, it's gone up 65%. Now, of course, you're getting more of the oldest old. Usually when they do age-adjusted rates, they break it down into like 5-year things or 10-year things, and this is kind of lumping everybody 65 plus. So it might be a little less than that when you're really breaking it, when you're comparing the oldest old. But either way, it's a substantial increase from falls. Bonus article 27, Consumer Product Safety Commission puts onus on Amazon for sale of hazardous third-party products. So Amazon is not doing a good job of screening nor responding when they are told that there are hazardous third-party products on their site. Need to do a better job, Amazon. Bonus article 28, there's more data for trans people with HIV than any other disease, but it's still flawed. So in public health, data collection is really important. A problem well-defined is half solved, but you need to actually measure things and assess things. Bonus article 29, San Francisco will offer homeless people bus tickets out of town before shelter or housing. So this is in the wake of the Supreme Court decision that allowed us basically to criminalize homeless people more easily. Now, San Francisco has offered bus tickets before, but now they're saying you must offer a bus ticket to every single person seeking shelter. Can you imagine going to a shelter every day and have to be offered a bus ticket every single day? It's degrading. And San Francisco is supposed to be a liberal center. Yeah, right. Bonus article 30, politics is holding back the best tool for treating meth addiction, financial incentives. Another one, meth addiction is so tied up with being ground down on the lower rungs of the social ladder that financial incentives actually works better as far as, for instance, documenting that you're staying clean, if you're in treatment, that type of thing. But hey, why don't we just lift that bottom ladder and not have people ground into where meth addiction looks like a better life? Bonus Article 31, to win Medicare for All, first reclaim Medicare from profiteers. So this is the expansion of Medicare Advantage in recent years, and we need to take that back so that traditional Medicare can rule the day. Bonus Article 32, how Kamala Harris ditched Medicare for All. So during her 2016 presidential run, she said that she was for Medicare for All. She backtracked on that quite quickly and now rejects single-payer healthcare. Bonus Article 33, Harris's California healthcare battles signal antitrust fights ahead for hospitals if she wins. So when she was the California Attorney General, she did a lot of antitrust works, mergers and things like that, to try to fight monopolies in healthcare, which can raise costs. So given that we have a wild west of mergers and stuff, that might help. The part of the problem is that cow has already left the barn because we are living in a very highly concentrated healthcare. Virtually all the markets are heavily concentrated. There isn't much competition, so it's kind of a little late for that, but hey. Bonus Article 34, last but not least, making caregiving a defining issue of the 2024 election. So this is an opinion piece that was triggered by the fact that for about 20 or 30 seconds, Kamala Harris, in her initial campaign speech, mentioned caregiving as a possible issue to deal with because she has personal experience with that. So, hey, I'd be all for that. We need to recognize and support caregivers as we have an aging population and many people have disabled folks in their families and loved ones. You can view these and all the other stories I've reported on in this episode and previously by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.